My name is Trace, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of an AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addictions. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups and their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Todd will read the preamble.
Good evening, I'm Todd, I'm an alcoholic. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share the experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Irina will read the steps.
My name is Irina and I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we have harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Abe will read the traditions.
My name is Abe, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA is a membership. For AA, membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group would never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such will never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name would never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Rocco.
Hi, Rocco, alcoholic. Kind of funny, like when they said my name just now, I was thinking, like, just don't go up there, you know, and like see what happens, just like be like, that's not my name. and I don't know, I mean, I guess that's how like I was before I came into the program, like I don't know, like I never showed up for things, and I just thought people wouldn't notice, you know? And I just thought, like, people wouldn't be harmed by it. And I just thought, you know, I was only affecting me. But obviously, if I didn't, I'm shaking right now. I don't know why. anyway, obviously, if I didn't stand up right now, you know, the whole group would be affected. We wouldn't have a 10-minute speaker. But I'm sure Mark or James would have got up and made me get up. So, anyway, and I'm just very grateful to be here and to be sober. And it's such a trip. Like 4 years ago when I came in here, me and my friends sat in the back, and I was like, these people are crazy. Like, they're so happy and they're so fake and, like, whatever. Like, I'm going to be just like them, except, you know, we're just going to keep using. And, like, we'll just say we have a bunch of time. And then they'll let us speak. And then I'll come up here and tell everyone why they're so wrong. And, like, exactly what's wrong with them and how they really need to do it. And why this works for you guys, but why I don't need it. But, I was wrong, and and you know, I need this, and I need to be willing to do this. I guess that was the difference. Anyway, and I'm just very grateful that Drew gave me the honor and the privilege to speak. I've known Drew since I came in. Me and him had the same sponsor. Mark P was my sponsor when I first came in. And Mark P is Jero's sponsor, and like it's so funny because me and Jero and Rajesh all had we took a trip one time to Vermont for like a big book study, and I drove us up there, and like I don't know what happened on the way up there, but like someone annoyed me or something, so I was like whatever, like let them find their own way home. And I let them, like, find their own way home. And I didn't feel guilty about that. And the fact that, like, 4 years later, Jerome has seen a change in me, and he's allowed me to speak at his home group and to do service and to carry a message of Alcoholics Anonymous to other people, it's just, like, it's amazing. Like, I don't know. I don't know why I'm shaking. I wish I had, like, a chair or something. So anyway, I was always very like disconnected from people, but I always acted like I wasn't, because I didn't want anyone to see how I really felt, because I was just always in too much pain. Like, I just never felt like I could relate to anyone, or just like, I just felt like there was this blocker that like I could see, but no one else could. And like when I drank, that blocker went down, and like, you know, my behavior when I drank was fun, and like everyone loved me. But I mean, like, usually there'd be like one or two people that hated me from that night, but like there'd be like 20 or 30 people who thought I was so funny that night. So I thought the trade-off was fine. And then, it was great. And then, one quick drunk story. Like, I was living out in London and playing rugby, and I would get these spasms in my stomach that would make me like keel over. I just saw a friend, and it almost made me cry. it would almost make me like keel over, and I thought I had sports hernia, and I was like, oh man, I'm gonna like get kicked off the team, and I'm gonna have to like go back to America, and blah 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 blah. And then I went to the doctor to like get it checked on, and he was like, you don't have a hernia, your liver's you're getting like liver spasms from detoxing. And I was like, oh, okay, I don't need surgery. And he's like, no, but you need to stop drinking. And I was like, whatever. So then I like eventually got kicked off the team, and then I came back to New York, and I started dating a guy that was in the program, and you know, he never told me I needed AA or anything. I don't think he did. I mean, I know he would like read the big book to me. Like, well, I mean, like, he would read it to me like when I was like drunk, you know, and like it was like the funny stories, and I was just like, oh, that's so funny. And then like he would tell me about like the people that like James and Ava and all these people, and I'm like, that's great. So I'd go to the meetings, and like so I started going to the meetings because like things got worse, and I just saw the 5 minute sign, so I'm just trying to go faster. And so anyway, I met Mark because I knew I needed to have a sponsor, because that's what I heard about. And Mark was like, are you willing to go to any lengths? And he's like throwing out all these things at me. And I'm just like, yeah, okay, yeah, fine, yeah. And like, I can't even like see this guy's face, right? Because like, I'm so like hungover from the night before. So I'm just like, yeah, sure. Then like 3 days later, he's like, what meeting are you going to today? And I'm just like, I don't think I'm going to go to a meeting. And he's like, you just said you're willing to go to any lengths. And I was like, that was 3 days ago. And like, so that's like where my program was for like 3 years, right? And like that didn't work. And I remember Mark saying something to me one time when I was like really messed up, that kind of struck me. He was like, I just see this kid that I relate so much to, and I just want to give him the gift that was given me, and he doesn't want it, and I just want to like give it to him, and he just doesn't want it. And I was just like, that sucks, you know? Oh, sorry, I didn't. But that hit me later on. And then, so then one night, after just like, you know, not having a sponsor for a couple of months, and I had a great friend, like, she's like a sister, and, I mean, the love and patience this girl shows me, I was in this room, and I was in just so much pain, and like, just to see everyone like being recovered, and I'm just like, I'm never gonna be like you people. No matter how hard I try, I'm like not gonna be able to be like this, you know? And my partner was in Sundance, and I was like, I'm gonna kill myself tonight. It's I'm done, you know? And we were leaving, and I told her this, and it just came out. I was like, I need a sponsor. And she was like, who? And I was like, James. Like, I don't know why I said that. So she just starts, like, screaming James in, like, the courtyard area. And then James comes over, and he's all happy hands. And I'm just like, I'm like, oh, this isn't going to work. And then, you know, so then I relapsed, like, 20 times from, like, January to, like, April 27th, which was my sobriety day. And James was with me every step of the way. Like, I'd go to meetings, and people would be like, they would corner me after meetings, like, you need to be in a rehab, you need to be in this. And I would go to James's office, and he was like, if you want to go to a rehab, we would look that up, and I'll be, like, every step of the way with you, or we can do this in the rooms, you know? I chose to do it in the rooms. And then one night, he gave me Van's last sobriety coin. And, like, Van was one of the founders of AG. And I was just like, I just wanted to throw it at him. I was like, what? No. Because, like, that's, like, I've been given a lot, but that was way more than I could ever accept. So that was, like, such a deep seed. And I don't know, that gave me faith to, like, do the work and to, like, continue on a journey. Because, like, in the big book talks about, like, you know, when you're, like when you're walking down the, I forget, like, the spiritual path of, like, with a newcomer or whatever. I'm nervous, whatever, right? But you know what I'm saying? And it's like I wanted to walk down that spiritual path with James, and, like, I was able to, like, go through the steps with him, and it's changed my life. Like, 4 years I've had a partner, like, and I didn't even, like, I thought I loved the guy, and, like, I didn't even know what love was until, like, I really did the steps, you know? And, like, now I really love him, and it's, like, it's, I don't even know. It's, like, I'm just so grateful for this and this room and, like, just everything I've been given, and it's just... That's it. Right.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Jeannie.
Hi, I'm Jeannie, and I'm an alcoholic. And he just tore me up. Like, wow. Because all those people that he mentioned are completely a part of my story as well, which is all you guys in this room. I want to thank Debbie for asking me to speak. She's also my sponsor, and she's back tonight. And when I walked in the door tonight, she was talking to her sponsor, James, and who's my grand sponsor, and she saw me, and she lit up, and then she said, okay, what are you wearing? Let me check. And that's my story, basically. Like, I, as far as coming into this group and learning how to be a lady, because the way it was for me and the way I was living, I was not that. Oh, I hope I can get through this. Well, I thought I was, but I didn't have any principles because, well, I had principles. I heard the other night in a meeting that I was living by principles. They were just all the backwards, upside down, wrong principles. I didn't, I had this horrible self-centered fear that I grew up with. And, you know, I grew up in a family in Pennsylvania that was chaotic and everything else. And I used that for a long time to drink and use. And I blamed and rationalized and justified that's why I'm an alcoholic. And that's not why I'm an alcoholic. And I've heard that from up here before, too. And I didn't get that. I thought, really, that my circumstances in life were just so awful that I had to drink because I had so much pain. And I deserved to drink because I had so much hurt. And I honestly thought those feelings would kill me. So when I found alcohol, it's described in the big book, which is this. If you're new, in the back, it's the textbook to how to get better. And I had a bunch of these. In fact, I'm going through storages right now because I'm moving into my own apartment with the lease. My name on a lease, oh my God. And I have about 8 of these all in boxes. And I didn't realize, like, that they were, and they had my name on the side, like, you know, with the year, because I had guessed I'd been in and out a lot and didn't even realize I'd been in and out a lot. Like, that's how much, that's how far I had crossed over the line of insanity. So what would happen to me is I would drink when I found alcohol, and all that self-centered fear and pain would go away. It would just, I just felt like that sense of ease and comfort that Dr. Bob talks about in this book that comes at once when taking the drink. And the drink, I would take the drink takes the drink, and then the drink took me. And then I was off to the races. I would go to rehabs. I guess that's where I got those big books. And I would go to rehabs, and they would say, and I, because I thought my problem was other than alcohol. I thought I had other drug problems. And I did. But when they told me that I had to stop drinking, there was just no way. So I would leave 28-day programs. I would get on a plane, and I would order a drink. And before I knew it, by the next morning, I would be back to, as we called it in treatment, ripping and running. And finally, that went on long enough to where I realized that I have a problem with alcohol and that I need to stop drinking somehow, because drinking always started and ended everything. And I ended up, basically my story, I'm going to push forward. Basically my story, I ended up completely homeless, destitute, in the Chelsea Hotel alone, living in a room, and I thought it was cool. I thought it was cool because that's where all the cool rock and rollers were, and I was doing everything they were doing, and I thought it was cool having men up to my room. I thought it was cool. That's how you make money. I just thought all of it was really down and cool and amazing, and until, you know, the consequences kept getting pretty bad. Like, you know, I'd wake up and I didn't, of course, remember what happened the night before, and all my money was gone. Or I'd wake up. One time we had gone to an after hours, and somehow everybody had gone home except me. I wasn't done. And I remember getting out of a cab, and I had had my money in my hand. And a guy came up behind me, and he pushed me into a vestibule, and he asked for all my money. And I said, "You're not getting my money." And he pulled out a gun, and he put it to my head. And I said, "Go ahead, pull the trigger, please, pull the trigger." And he wouldn't. And it's like he didn't. And that's God, or maybe he was like, "She's not even worth killing for me to go to jail for." You know, like that's how, I was pretty pathetic. Like, I was like, "Go ahead, do it. You know, I dare you." And you know, he smashed my nose. He broke my nose, smashed my face, blood everywhere. I had like a short leather coat on with a white fur collar, covered in blood, and I still wouldn't give him my money. He spit on me, he kicked me, he walks out of the vestibule, and I'm like, "Ha, I won." Like, that's my disease. That's how resistant and non-compliant. It's like when you were talking, like, about leaving the guy there, you know, like leaving them at the thing. It's like, nobody misses. Nobody cares. Who cares? You know, I got home, and it was like people were like, "What? Look at you. What?" You know, no, it didn't. I didn't think I affected others. I didn't think that behavior affected other people, because I was hurting badly, and I hurt people, and hurt people, hurt themselves. So here I stand, it's 4 years later. My sobriety date is December 7th, 2005. And I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That sound good, Debbie? Like, I really want to like quote the book, but I'm like, how do you do that and tell your story and like do, and then it's like, you know what? I'll just throw it in when I can. But it's true. Like, I can't put it any better than that. I have recovered. I mean, since I've gotten sober, I haven't gotten arrested. No cops have stopped me. Nobody's put me in jail. You know, nobody has done anything like that to me. Not that I'm all perfect and a saint and everything else, but I live by principles today of honesty, usefulness, love, purity, You know, I live in an environment that's really safe. Well, sane, I don't know, but Debbie says safe, sane, and protected. And I've been working to create that in my life. I ended up going to a city detox where this group brought in the message. And there's a table over there. And if you want to give back what was so freely given to you, I would say go over there and sign up to take a meeting into a detox, because I'm one of those people that it, I heard the message. And I heard the message because this group does amazing service. And that's why I'm here tonight, you know, to try to tell the person in the back of the room that you don't have to drink ever again. You know, there's people in this room that are going to go out this week and next week, and they're going to die. And I'm telling you the truth, they're going to die. And the one person in this room that's sitting there saying it's not going to be me, that's the person that better open their ears, because I had a very dear friend in treatment who said that's not going to be me, and she's dead. She's not here. She's no longer with us because this disease took her. And the holiday season, it's rough, but the feelings won't kill you. What will kill you are the substances. What will kill you is drinking. What will kill you is not calling your sponsor. What will kill you is not telling the truth about how scared you are to be alone at this time of year. That's what kills me. When I don't tell my sponsor, you know, before I walked up here, that my whole story just went out of my head, and I don't even know what I'm going to talk about. And I have 1 minute. Oh, my God. So I just know I have so much gratitude to this group. I have so much gratitude to the service and the love that you guys show me. I never thought I would be part of a sober family. I thought that was really creepy and corny. Like, really creepy. And row 12 is like my heart and soul. And I may not talk to you guys every day, or we may not, but it's just I walk in here and I see their faces, and they call me every day and they tell me they love me. My sober sister called me this morning, and I said, oh my God, I'm never going to do it, blah, 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 blah. She says to me, Jeannie, Christine says to me, Jeannie, where's G-O-D? And I said, who? Because I'm running everything. She says, God's running the show. You're not running the show. God's in charge. And that's how I have to live my life today, and I have the goodbye, and thank you very much for allowing me to share.
Our main speaker tonight is Grant.
Thanks. Thank you. Hi, my name's Grant. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, my God, what a good-looking group. Yeah. Having, like, flashbacks to high school. He's so good-looking. I want to thank my fellow gladiators in the holding pen there, Rocco and Jeannie. Great message. I'm joking because I'm scared and I'm overwhelmed with this group. Feels like it puts forth the feeling I have about sobriety. And that's kind of a rare thing. And it's so overwhelming to me, the feeling I have about sobriety. I don't even feel like I celebrated 22 years in June. And I don't feel like the more the years go by, I feel like I have less and less words to describe the power of this thing, which I had absolutely no intention of getting when I came here. I had absolutely no intention of getting and staying sober. So you may be asking, well, then why would you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? I'll get to that, but, I just really wanted to, stay sober long enough to fix the outsides enough to fix the insides. And then once I got the outside stuff, I figured it was going to be okay to drink the way I wanted, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And when I was 15 years old, I knew I was an alcoholic. I just didn't know what alcoholism was. I used to cut the lawns of the neighbors on my street. And every once in a while, one of the neighbor fathers would go, "Would you like a lemonade or a beer?" And I was already drinking, and I'd say, "I'll have a lemonade," because I knew one beer. I had no interest in one beer. I didn't want to open up that can. Like, I didn't even know, I didn't know then that that was a physical allergy. That once I put it into my system, I could no longer control how much I put in after that. So on a Saturday afternoon, I couldn't have one beer. And I knew that at 15 years old. But I didn't know that was alcoholism. And my drinking sort of looked, well, I was in high school. I can't even say my drinking looked like everybody else's drinking, because I ran with about 10 guys who one of their fathers had passed away at one of his football games, and his mom knew what we were doing. And she said, "Well, I don't want you driving around out on the streets doing what you're doing." So she opened up her basement to us, and we had a refrigerator full of beer, and we had mattresses on the floor and mattresses on the wall, and paraphernalia hidden in the ceiling tiles. And and I remember, and we'd go there at lunch, because we had an open campus, and we'd go there at lunch, and then I'd go there after school. And I remember with, my back against the mattress going, "How am I going to keep this going? Because this is all I really want to do. This is really the only way I can handle life." So that wasn't a that wasn't a good starting off point. Like, how am I going to get through the rest of this? This is all I feel like I can do and want to do. And I somehow got into a college, and I joined a fraternity, and had my face under a keg for 4 years, and somehow graduated, which is a total indictment of our educational system. One semester I got a 0.075, which is a D, three Fs, and an incomplete. I mean, that takes effort. I mean, I don't get functioning alcoholics. Like those of you who come in here like running Fortune 200 companies. I'm like, how'd you do that? I got a 0.075. And I, by the end of my college drinking career, my alcoholic friends were already starting to talk about me behind my back. And, I read this Bill Wilson biography where he's like in his little bedroom in Vermont, and he's looking in the mirror and he's going, "I'll show them, I'll show them." And that became like my mantra. It's like, I know these guys are talking about me, and I'll show them. So, I moved up to New York City, and as Bill Wilson says in Bill's story, like, the race for success was on. And, but I didn't know I had alcoholism. I just knew I liked to drink. I liked the feeling produced by alcohol. And it was so important to me. If you had asked me, any given morning, what's the most important thing to you in your life? It's that I do this thing, that I moved up to New York City, not knowing a soul, that I get to do this thing that I want to do. And my alcoholism didn't care about that thing, because I started, I chose a profession, and I started, I started getting work, and I started, I had to be at work at 3 p.m. for a job I absolutely had to have, and I couldn't get out of bed at 2 p.m. because I had like alcohol poisoning. And so I'll just flash forward to what brought me into this program. I told some friends of mine. I knew this guy who I had worked with, and he had a fiance who I had met once, and they bought a house in upstate New York, and they invited me up to visit them. and I had to work Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, then I had Monday off. So I was going to take a train Sunday afternoon after work, upstate New York, and they were going to pick me up at the train station. But like Rocco mentioned, I just wasn't a show-up guy after a night of doing what I like to do. And so, you know, I worked on Saturday. Saturday afternoon, I got on a bus down to Atlantic City, and there I transferred to a bus down to the Jersey Shore, 3.5-hour bus ride, to go party with my friends from high school for the night, having to be back at work at 3 o'clock on Sunday. And I didn't dare go to sleep that Saturday night because the bus was going to pick me up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't miss that bus. So you know what that ride was like, you know, like just my face on the cold glass, you know, and then I went to work at 3 o'clock and somehow got through work and went home and passed out. No phone call to my friends waiting for me at the train station. And I woke up that Monday like, oh, God, I gotta call them and tell them why I wasn't there. I'd made a million phone calls like that. I call and I get my friend's fiance, who I had met once. And I said, listen, I'm really sorry I couldn't make it up last night and I couldn't call you because my little brother at home in Philadelphia has a drinking and a drug problem. And my parents called me and it was a real family emergency. And, you know, I couldn't call you. And this woman is on the other end of the line going, I'm so sorry, Grant. I hope he's okay. And halfway through this lie that I was completely getting away with, out of my mouth comes, you know what, I'm lying to you. I drank too much last night and I couldn't make it up. I'd lied to so many other people, so much. There were so much closer to me than this woman. And there was a pause on the other end of the phone. She goes, that's okay. She goes, you know, I go to AA. And I went, AA, whoa, whoa, whoa. The only thing I knew about AA was I was living down the street from Gramercy Park, and I used to go jogging around the park on Friday nights before I was going to go out drinking because I was such a health nut. And there was a meeting right off the park, you know. It was like this, like a church like this, and it had, you know, that stone archway with the yellow light bulb over it, and I would see people outside with, like, styrofoam cups and cigarettes, and somehow I knew that was an AA meeting. And my only thought about that was those poor people. You know, they'll never be able to drink again for the rest of their lives. And I don't know how I knew that's what AA was about, but that's all I knew about AA. Those poor people, they can't drink anymore. I think that would be about the worst thing that could befell anybody. So she says AA, and I had all my reasons as to why I wasn't an alcoholic all saved up, just like it talks about in the big book. I lost a job one time directly because of my drinking, and I didn't drink for 3 weeks until I got another job. And then you know what I did. But I didn't drink for those 3 weeks. And I told her all my reasons as to why I wasn't an alcoholic. Since I came into the program, you know, I realized people who don't have an issue with alcohol don't sit around thinking up reasons why they're not alcoholics. But I gave those to her, and I'm sorry, who's my timekeeper? Ah, well, can't miss that. And once again, there was a pause on the other end of the phone, and she goes, well, you know, this woman ended up being my Eskimo. She goes, well, I have a cocaine problem. And she goes, and I still do cocaine about once every 2 months. She goes, but I go to these AA meetings so that maybe I won't do it at all. Because it's not how often I do it, it's how it makes me feel afterwards. And that went right through me. You know, that was my first experience of one alcoholic talking to another. Because all I knew about the morning, the day after, you know, we didn't sit around, you know, and talk about how incomprehensibly demoralized we felt. I thought I was the only one who felt that way. And just with that one sentence, it's not how often I do it, it's how it makes me feel afterwards. I understood, I suddenly had a definition for my incomprehensible demoralization around my drinking. And she said, you know, I have a friend in the city who goes to meetings and I'll give you her number. And that number sat on that coffee table for 2 weeks and I kept meaning to throw it out. And I don't know what, I can't even tell you what happened in those 2 weeks, but I ended up calling that woman. And I went to my first meeting over at the Y on Central Park West. And I didn't know my life was going to change that day. I didn't know that was going to be the day where my life was going to go in a completely different direction. You know, like Rocco said, I just didn't think I belonged. At the end of the meeting, they called on me, which I thought was rude. And, you know, because the woman I went with made me raise my hand when they said, "Is anybody here for the first time?" And she started nudging me. And I said, "You said I wouldn't have to say anything." She said, "Just say you're here for the first time." And there was, like, thunderous applause and made me very uncomfortable. And then it's the end of the meeting. He goes, "You, new guy, do you want to say something?" And I went, "All right, if they're going to put me on the spot, I'm going to give them both barrels." And I said, "Well, frankly, I don't know what I'm doing here because I don't think I'm an alcoholic." And the whole place erupted in laughter. And everybody stood up and, you know, said the Serenity Prayer. And then they took me to coffee, thank God, and kind of calmed me down. And that started my journey. Like I said, the sign of God is that we are led where we did not intend to go. I didn't just make that up. I heard somebody say it. So it took me 2 years to get a year because I didn't do certain things. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work a step. I went to meetings and basically told you how I was feeling. And I would usually feel better immediately after doing that until I walked out on the street again. And I had three slips in a year. And then I thought, well, what I really need to do is move to Los Angeles, and it'll be better there. And with 7 days of sobriety, I moved there, and then circumstances brought me back, and the people in the program were great because they were like, you know, "What are you doing, Grant?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm just here for, you know, a little while, and then I'm going back to L.A. And they said, "Well, why don't you wait till you get your 90 days before you go back to L.A.?" And I'm like, "You know, you don't understand. Things are happening out there that I need to be there for." And they were like, "Well, you know," and they knew I was all about getting what I wanted. And they were like, "Well, it's like you got a tray in front of you right now. And right now you got 20 days worth of stuff on your tray. Wouldn't you rather have 90 days worth of stuff on your tray to offer those people in Los Angeles?" And I was like, 90 days of stuff is better than 20 days. Now, like, I didn't know what stuff they were talking about or what tray they were talking about. You know, all I know is, like, I have a better chance of getting what I want if I get 90 days. So I'm like, I'll do everybody a big favor and stay in New York and get my 90 days and then, you know, go out to Los Angeles. And then I was at the 79th Street Workshop, and I heard a guy with an English accent. I'm going to butcher it. I'm sorry to our friend from England. But he said, "I promised myself by the time I turned 55, I would have a Bentley." And he said, "When I turned 55, I was riding my bike down the street. And I had just gotten out of rehab, and it was a beautiful fall day, and the sun was coming through the trees, and I'd never been happier in my life." And I thought, thank you. I want what that guy has. Because... remorse and spiritual malady doesn't even begin to describe what I was feeling. And I asked them to sponsor me, and I didn't know why. Well, I figured, you know, I could kind of glean what I could off and put it on my tray and go out to L.A. And I meet him. He said, "Meet me at the Green Kitchen." Which is a diner on 74th Street. And I meet him there, and he goes, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" And I thought, yeah, for the next 65 days. And he would meet me at the Green Kitchen for fun and for free. And then he had me to dinner in his apartment. His wife was cooking dinner. And I said, "Oh, by the way, just so you know, I'm going to Los Angeles after I get my 90 days. And he goes, "I don't want you to go anywhere for a year." And this guy had no I'm eternally grateful for this guy. He cared less about my feelings than he did about me. And he said, "I don't want you to go anywhere for a year." He had no compunction about telling me what to do. And I said, "No, you know, you don't understand. Things are happening out there that I need to be there for." And he said, "I understand." He said, "You keep doing things your way and you keep drinking." He said, "You put this program first. Everything else will take care of itself better than you can do it." And that's all I wanted to hear. And I was so ready to give up my power to something other than me, because we all know the results we get from that and the pain that I get from that. So I made this, you know, everything inside of me was screaming, no, don't agree to this, and out of my mouth comes, okay. And I, you know, I'm going to AA meetings going, what, you know, why did I agree to this? And oh my God, it's like, I'm talking about how I feel and people are talking about how they feel and this is getting me nowhere and I've already messed up my life. I got to wait and make up for lost time. Why am I sitting in these AA meetings? He used to say things to me like, make your life a sobriety sandwich. And I'm like, what's that? You know, I was unemployed at the time and he's like, go to a morning meeting. Go have breakfast with alcoholics. Go talk about what you're going to do that morning. Go do what you're going to do that morning. Go to a lunch meeting. Go have lunch with alcoholics. Go do what you're going to do that afternoon. Go to a dinner meeting. I was going to, I'm like, if I'm in three meetings a day, how is my life going to get better? And he's like, I can't tell you how it works. It just does. And, you know, what he was doing was getting me out of, you know, not only my own way, but God's way. And, you know, lack of power is my dilemma. And I learned that really early on in this program, thanks to people like him. Because, you know, when I go with my power, when I go with my will, my unaided will, I get, you know, I feel pretty alcoholic and I need a drink. And when I give up my will to you know, a power greater than myself that I've found as a result of working these steps that you guys introduced me to in this program, when I am, you know, when I have a connection to that power and I can turn my life and my will over to that power, it's heaven on earth. It's what I used to look for in the bottle. And what I used to get until it stopped working. You know, it was pointed out to me I have a spiritual malady. That's why, you know, it's why I like spirits. Until the spirit stopped working. And I needed a spiritual solution for that spiritual malady. I'm physically different from my fellows. Once I put alcohol into my body, I can no longer control how much I drink after that. If that were my only problem, all I would do is put the plug in the jug and I'm good to go. But I got an alcoholic mind that perceives life in such a way that makes me need a drink. You know, if you pick up that 20-question pamphlet on drinking, you know, and just substitute thinking, it's like, did you ever think at home? Did you ever lose a job because of your thinking? And that my thinking creates a spiritual malady inside of me. I think I heard Clancy describe one time as a spring. It's like a spring that if it goes uninterrupted, it just gets tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter within me. And I 9 months into that commitment to staying in New York, I received a job offer to go out to Los Angeles where I proceeded to not drink for the next 4 to 5 years. And at 5 or 6 years of sobriety, because I made other things my higher power, and everything AA and sobriety had given me became my higher power. And, you know, they did things differently out there, and I didn't like it, and I'd go to meetings late, and I'd leave early, and I was going to like one meeting a week, because I had this, you know, I had to tend to this stuff. And at 5 or 6 years of sobriety, with you know, a lot of stuff on the outside that I thought was going to fix me, I was ready to drink again. And luckily, what I did instead was I knocked on the door of a guy who I had met once and couldn't stand, but a series of circumstances brought me to his door. And I said, will you take me through the steps? And, you know, we worked 1, 2, and 3, and we got to the 4th step and did an inventory, and I get to this fear inventory, and he said, you know, he boiled all my fears down to about 20. And then he said, I want you to write down the opposite of those fears. So it's like fear of being alone, opposite of that, fear of being in a committed relationship. Fear of dying, fear of living, fear of not working, fear of working. And I'm like, why am I afraid of all these things that I think I want? And he said, because you don't feel like you have the power to sustain it. He said, you need a higher power that you can rely on. And it was like, by doing that fear inventory, I really got the 3rd step, you know, how I need a power greater than me, other than my own unaided will. And, you know, I've paid therapists $200 an hour, and they didn't come up with that stuff. And I did amends for the first time. And I said, how, you know, we get to the eighth step, and I said, how will I know when I'm ready to make amends? He said, you'll hear a noise. I said, what's that? He said, it's going to sound like this. That's going to be you knocking on the door of the person you're going to make an amend to. And you know, I made amends. It's weird, the stuff that dogged me anyway. Like, I made an amend to my high school basketball coach. My junior high basketball coach. Because we didn't get letters. You know those letters you put on your high school, you know, jacket? He wouldn't give us letters. The five guys on the end of the bench, of which I was one, he gave us certificates of completion, and everybody else got a. So we tore them up and put them in his mailbox. And you wouldn't think something like that would stay with you for the rest of your life until you put pen to paper, you know? And that's where, like, when they talk about, you know, what separates the men from the boys, or where the rubber meets the road, or I forget how they put it, but it's like when I was out in the parking lot, because he was now coaching basketball at my high school, when I was out in the parking lot of my high school in my mom's station wagon, with my hands just like pools of sweat, because I was going to go meet that guy in the cafeteria to apologize for my actions. And I thought to him, you know, I tried to get out of that one. I said to my sponsor, you know, I think it's just going to bring up pain for this guy. I don't want him to relive. I don't want him to have to relive that. You know, it was really hard for him at the time. And, you know, we're in the cafeteria, and I'm sitting opposite him, and I said, you know, I don't even know if you're going to remember this. And he said, you mean when you tore up the letters and put it in my – and I said, yeah. I said, I want you to know, you know, I regret that, and I've regretted it ever since I did it. And, you know, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous now. And, you know, I this is a necessary part of me not drinking. And he was like, wow. And he said, just so you know, ever since that happened, I gave everybody a letter. And I said, that's really not why I'm here. I'm here to, like, clean up my side of the street. And, you know, I had to fly to my alma mater, where I went to college, and apologize, make an amend to one of my professors who brought me up on charges for plagiarizing a paper, which I did, and which I managed to get. You know, he wanted me on kicked out of school for a year, and I had some fraternity brothers on the judicial board who gave me, you know, 6 months probation or whatever, and I put him through all of that. And, you know, thank you. In my alcoholic mind, he was out to get me, and I, you know, flew back there and met with him and made an amend for that. And I was not a part of this program, nor did I have anything to give anybody until I was willing to do that stuff. Because how could I tell anybody else to go do that until I did it, you know? And at 11 years of sobriety, English sponsor I had passed away. And 6 months after that, I got another sponsor who passed away last year. And that 11 years of sobriety, not only did that sponsor pass away, I had a relationship break up, I lost a job. I mean, I was on the floor at year 11. And I went to this guy, Scott R., and I said, you know, would you take me through the steps again? And out of all the bad things that was happening to me, I had open-heart surgery. This was all in, like, my 11th year. To think that relationship breaking up, I couldn't get free. Couldn't get free because of what she did to me. And I went to Scott and I said, I can't get free. And we did the first three steps in a room in his house like that. And he said, okay, write about it. Let's do a four step. And I did. And I didn't think I had anything to make amends for in that relationship, because if I told you what she did, you would understand that I was the victim. And you know, and I got to see what I needed to make amends for. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know when I'll be ready to make amends to this girl. And then I was at a job interview and she came walking in pregnant. And I turned around. She hadn't seen me yet. And I tried to make myself invisible. And I said to myself, what do I do here, God? And this voice came back to me. It's like, you can pay now or you can pay later with interest. And I went across the room and I said to her, can I see you outside after your business is done here? I'd just like to talk to you. And she said, sure. And I my nose started bleeding. And I was a little nervous about that one. And, we went outside and I made amends. And she stuck the knife in a few more times. And I walked away from there a free man. Because I didn't have to engage in... You know what I mean? Like, her stuff wasn't my side of the street, and I walked away from there free. So, I just got to keep doing what you guys taught me to do. Because I have alcoholism right now today. And Scott really introduced me to 10, 11, and 12, and continuing inventory. And I was just working this job. Have I hit 1 minute yet? 2 minutes. Okay, thanks. Just to wrap up, just to show you how these steps and this program is still working in my life 22 years later. And the only reason I could still show up for things in my life, and I'm living, I'm doing things that I dreamed about doing as a kid. And if you would ask me, would you even be capable or, would you be worthy of doing this kind of stuff, I would have told you no. And I had a job recently and I worked in a room like with three other guys, and they had a different bottle of booze. They'd go through a bottle. They were drinking a lot, and how people say, I'm going to my office Christmas party, and I'm going to a meeting before, and I mean really girding myself for it. It was like that every night for 3 months. It felt like going to the office Christmas party, but this job was very important to me, and I started feeling like these guys don't like, because I don't go out with them afterwards. Thank you. These guys don't like me. I started feeling separate from, and I put that pen to paper one more time, and I got to that fourth column, and I got to see, I'm afraid. I selfishly want them to live the way I think they should be living. Like the character defects were long, and I got to see, I was afraid of them judging me. I was judging them left, right, and center. And it's why I felt apart from. And I asked to have those character defects removed, and I went into work the next day, and they reacted differently to me because, God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. On my own power, all I can do is show up there in judgment and feel apart from. And, when I put this process in motion, it does for me what I can't do for myself. So I want to thank Heidi for asking me to speak, and thanks.